Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome back, and thanks as always for listening. With the fall oral boards in surgical oncology, colorectal, vascular, and general surgery fast approaching, we want to remind you to check out the study resources at behindtheknife.org. Each of our oral board audio review series contain carefully crafted scenarios designed to help you dominate the board. Each scenario includes two parts. The first is a perfectly executed back and forth between examiner and examinee that mimics the real thing. Scenarios are 5 to 7 minutes long and include a variety of tactics and styles. If you're able to achieve this level of performance in your preparation, you are sure to pass the oral boards with flying colors. Now, the second part introduces high-yield commentary to each scenario. This commentary includes tips and tricks to help you dominate the most challenging scenarios, in addition to practical, easy-to-understand teaching that covers the most confusing topics we face as surgeons. We are confident you will find this unique, dual-format approach a highly effective way to prepare for your boards. Again, check out behindtheknife.org for more. We hope you enjoy the case.
Behind the Knife Premium.
This is ulcerative colitis. The author is Jonathan Abelson. The examiner is Jonathan Abelson. The examinee is Patrick Georgioff. A 27-year-old male presents to the ER with 3 weeks of worsening abdominal pain and 10 to 12 bloody bowel movements per day. He was in his usual state of health before this and has no known sick contacts. He has no prior medical or surgical history. He's a non-smoker and his family history is unremarkable. He has never had a colonoscopy before. How would you like to evaluate him?
I would go down to the emergency department immediately to evaluate this patient. I would want to make sure he is on the monitor with a recent set of vital signs, that he has high quality IV access with IV fluids running as well. And I would perform a focused physical exam with a cardiopulmonary examination, abdominal exam, and a rectal exam.
He's placed on a monitor and has IV fluids running. His heart rate is 110. His blood pressure, respirations, and temperature are all normal. Cardiopulmonary examination is normal other than the tachycardia. Abdominal exam reveals mild diffuse distension and tenderness to palpation. There's no peritonitis. There's no surgical scars or hernias. And rectal exam is normal without masses or blood.
Okay, I would obtain a full set of labs, including CBC, CMP, and coagulation studies. I would also order stool studies to rule out C. diff and other infectious issues.
Okay, his white count is elevated at 25,000. His hemoglobin is decreased at 9. The remainder of his labs are normal and his stool studies are pending. What's on your differential diagnosis?
Sure. With this information, I'm concerned that this could represent a new presentation of inflammatory bowel disease, most likely ulcerative colitis in the setting of bloody diarrhea. He could also have an infectious etiology such as C. diff. Other causes of bloody diarrhea include ischemic colitis, but this would be unlikely in this patient given his age and comorbidities.
All right, what would you like to do next?
Yeah, I would go ahead with a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis to evaluate for the severity and extent of colitis. I would also consult
GI would recommend proceeding with flexible sigmoidoscopy and include biopsies as part of that.
All right, CT abdomen pelvis is obtained and reveals colitis extending from the rectum proximally to the mid-transverse colon. There's no pneumoperitoneum or colon dilation. Flexible sigmoidoscopy reveals continuous inflammation from the rectum to the descending colon with contact bleeding. You obtain biopsies and they're pending.
Okay, so I have a 27-year-old man who's presenting with bloody diarrhea and imaging and endoscopy concerning for acute severe ulcerative colitis. And after confirming that there's no infectious etiologies on the stool studies, I would want to start him on methylprednisone, 20 milligrams every 8 hours, and perform serial abdominal exams and keep him NPO for the time being.
All right, he gets better on IV steroids and is started on infliximab and is eventually weaned off of IV steroids and discharged home. He presents to the ER 3 weeks later with recurrent bloody diarrhea and abdominal pain. And on exam, he's tachycardic to 110 and he's febrile to 39.5 degrees Celsius. He has focal left lower quadrant tenderness. His white blood cell count is 25,000 and the remainder of his labs are normal. How would you like to manage him now?
Yeah, I'm concerned the patient has toxic colitis and requires emergent open total abdominal colectomy with end ileostomy. I would talk to the patient about the rationale, the risks, and the benefits for the surgery. I would make sure that he is fully resuscitated, and I would mark a stoma in the preoperative area as well.
All right, he agrees with your plan, and you proceed to the OR for open total abdominal colectomy. You note a focal perforation in the descending colon with feculent peritonitis. How are you going to manage the rectal stump?
Yeah, so my options are to leave the rectal stump in the pelvis with adjacent drainage. I could bring it up through the fascia as a buried mucous fistula, or I could mature it as a mucous fistula. And I would base my decision on how healthy the tissue is and whether it can hold a staple line, and how easily I would be able to mobilize the stump and bring it up to the abdominal wall. I would ideally favor creating a buried mucous fistula, given my concern for a rectal stump blowout based on the patient's history. I would also thoroughly examine the small bowel to confirm there is no evidence of creeping fat to suggest Crohn's disease, and make a preliminary assessment of whether he's a candidate for a J-pouch based on small bowel reach.
All right, so you perform a total abdominal colectomy with an end ileostomy and buried mucous fistula of the rectal stump. There's no evidence of small bowel disease, and there appears to be adequate reach for a pouch. He recovers well postoperatively. You're seeing him back in the clinic in 1 month, and he asks you if the ileostomy can be reversed.
Yeah, I'd want to review the final pathology closely to confirm that this is consistent with ulcerative colitis. I would then discuss with the patient the options of completion proctectomy with either permanent end ileostomy or iliopouch anal anastomosis to restore GI continuity. In either case, I would review with him the risks and benefits of each approach, including expected quality of life with a J-pouch with approximately 6 to 10 bowel movements per day and possibility of nighttime fecal incontinence. I would assess also his nutritional status and ensure that he is optimized preoperatively.
All right, he decides he does want to proceed with a J-pouch, so briefly describe your technique.
I would start by opening the midline incision and taking down the rectal stump from the abdominal wall. I would proceed with completion proctectomy, and prior to dividing the rectum distally, I would take down the ileostomy and make sure I assess the reach of the planned J-pouch. I would then transect the rectum and create a 15-centimeter ileal pouch by making an enterotomy at the anti-mesenteric border of the apex of the pouch using two loads of a GIA 75-millimeter blue load stapler. I would then sew in the anvil of an EEA 29-millimeter stapler and perform an end-to-end stapled pouch to anal anastomosis, ensuring there's no tension on the anastomosis itself. I would then make a diverting loop ileostomy 20 centimeters proximal to the body of the pouch.
All right, let's say that you're having difficulty with reach of the pouch. What are some of your pouch lengthening maneuvers?
Yeah, I would make sure that the small bowel mesentery is completely mobilized off of the retroperitoneum all the way up to the ligament of Treitz. I could also divide the ileocolic vessels at its takeoff of the superior mesenteric artery. And I could also make a transverse mesenteric relaxing incisions on both sides of the mesentery through the peritoneum.
All right, let's say that on post-op day 7, he develops fever, tachycardia, pelvic pain, and urinary retention. You obtain blood cultures, urine cultures, and CT chest, abdomen, pelvis. And this reveals a rim-enhancing pelvic fluid collection with partial disruption of the pouch anal staple anastomosis. How are you going to manage him?
Yeah, I'm concerned that he has an anastomotic leak and is developing pelvic sepsis despite proximal diversion. And so I start him on empiric broad-spectrum antibiotics, begin fluid resuscitation in place of Foley catheter. I would then consent him for laparoscopic possible open pelvic washout with exam under anesthesia and possible drain placement, depending on findings.
Be sure to listen to Part B for high-yield commentary and other tips and tricks. Behind the Knife Premium.
This is Ulcerative Colitis. The author is Jonathan Abelson. The examiner is Jonathan Abelson. The examinee is Patrick Georgioff. A 27-year-old male presents to the ER with 3 weeks of worsening abdominal pain and 10 to 12 bloody bowel movements per day. He was in his usual state of health before this and has no known sick contacts. He has no prior medical or surgical history. He's a non-smoker and his family history is unremarkable. He has never had a colonoscopy before. How would you like to evaluate him?
I would go down to the emergency department immediately to evaluate this patient. I would want to make sure he is on the monitor with a recent set of vital signs, that he has high quality IV access with IV fluids running as well. And I would perform a focused physical exam with a cardiopulmonary examination, abdominal exam, and a rectal exam.
Always remember your ABCs when you are presented with a potentially sick patient on the boards. First and foremost, the examiners want to make sure that you are a safe surgeon. Do not forget to resuscitate your patient, that they've updated vital signs, and that they are stabilized. He's placed on a monitor and has IV fluids running. His heart rate is 110. His blood pressure, respirations, and temperature are all normal. Cardiopulmonary examination is normal other than the tachycardia. Abdominal exam reveals mild diffuse distension and tenderness to palpation. There's no peritonitis. There's no surgical scars or hernias. And rectal exam is normal without masses or blood.
Okay, I would obtain a full set of labs, including CBC, CMP, and coagulation studies. I would also order stool studies to rule out C. diff and other infectious issues.
Early on in the scenario, you will need to start building your differential diagnosis and asking for specific tests to rule in or, in certain conditions, rule out. You are presented with a young male with abdominal pain and bloody bowel movements. The limited differential for bloody diarrhea with abdominal pain is ischemic colitis, IBD, and infectious colitis. Ischemic colitis would be very unlikely in an otherwise healthy 27-year-old male. Therefore, it will be important to rule out infectious etiologies before settling on a new diagnosis of either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Classically, ulcerative colitis is more likely than Crohn's disease to present with bloody diarrhea. Okay, his white count is elevated at 25,000. His hemoglobin is decreased at 9. The remainder of his labs are normal and his stool studies are pending. What's on your differential diagnosis?
Sure. With this information, I'm concerned that this could represent a new presentation of inflammatory bowel disease, most likely ulcerative colitis in the setting of bloody diarrhea. He could also have an infectious etiology such as C. diff. Other causes of bloody diarrhea include ischemic colitis, but this would be unlikely in this patient given his age and comorbidities.
All right, what would you like to do next?
Yeah, I would go ahead with a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis to evaluate for the severity and extent of colitis. I would also consult GI and would recommend proceeding with flexible sigmoidoscopy and include biopsies as part of that.
It's not absolutely necessary to obtain a CT abdomen pelvis in this clinical setting. CT would certainly be helpful, to confirm perforation or toxic megacolon if that was a clinical concern. This patient does not have signs of shock or peritonitis. It can be helpful, however, to confirm the extent and severity of colitis, and it's not unreasonable to ask for in this scenario. There may be several scenarios where you ask for a consult and they are not available. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be asking for help from GI or interventional radiology or urology or some other consulting service. You want to make sure you have a specific question for them, but already have in mind what you would want them to do or say. This is a young patient with likely a new diagnosis of acute severe ulcerative colitis, and as long as they remain clinically stable, it's appropriate to do further workup and medical management with a GI consult, including flexible sigmoidoscopy. Flexible sigmoidoscopy is helpful with the diagnosis to determine the presence, anatomical extent, and severity of colitis. It also allows for tissue biopsy to evaluate for IBD or CMV colitis. All right, CT abdomen pelvis is obtained and reveals colitis extending from the rectum proximally to the mid-transverse colon. There's no pneumoperitoneum or colon dilation. Flexible sigmoidoscopy reveals continuous inflammation from the rectum to the descending colon with contact bleeding. You obtain biopsies and they're pending.
Okay, so I have a 27-year-old man who's presenting with bloody diarrhea and imaging and endoscopy concerning for acute severe ulcerative colitis. And after confirming that there's no infectious etiologies on the stool studies, I would want to start him on methylprednisone, 20 milligrams every 8 hours, and perform serial abdominal exams and keep him NPO for the time being.
It is always good practice to summarize a complex case on the oral boards. This shows the examiner that you're adept at synthesizing many different pieces of information to arrive at a final assessment and plan. It goes without saying that you should be able to differentiate UC from Crohn's disease based on this clinical description. In hospitalized patients with a UC flare, intravenous methylprednisolone 40 to 60 milligrams daily is typically recommended as first-line therapy. In general, these patients should be continued on a diet as tolerated. Bowel rest has no real additional benefit other than to deprive these patients of their nutritional reserves. Just as we have stated, we're ruling out C. diff. It's very important to rule out cytomegalovirus, which is done during flexible sigmoidoscopy with a biopsy for culture. IV steroids would be contraindicated if the C. diff or CMV are positive. Do not hesitate to mention in these patient presentations early evaluation by WOCN and stoma marking in the event the patient does require an emergent total abdominal colectomy with endoileostomy. It's important to monitor these patients closely for signs of clinical improvement. This would manifest with decreased stool frequency, hematochezia, downward trend in serum C-reactive protein, and improvement in overall clinical status. Fecal calprotectin may also be used to monitor disease activity. If there's insufficient improvement in the 3 to 5 days after initiation of high-dose steroids, intravenous infliximab at a dose of 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram is considered as rescue therapy. You will likely not be expected to know this dosage. Historically, intravenous cyclosporin was also used as rescue therapy, although this is much less commonly employed. Both infliximab and cyclosporin have a median response time of approximately 5 to 7 days. Total abdominal colectomy is then reserved for patients who do not respond appropriately or clinically worsen during this interval. All right, he gets better on IV steroids and is started on infliximab and is eventually weaned off of IV steroids and discharged home. He presents to the ER 3 weeks later with recurrent bloody diarrhea and abdominal pain. And on exam, he's tachycardic to 110 and he's febrile to 39.5 degrees Celsius. He has focal left lower quadrant tenderness. His white blood cell count is 25,000 and the remainder of his labs are normal. How would you like to manage him now?
Yeah, I'm concerned the patient has toxic colitis and requires emergent open total abdominal colectomy with endoileostomy. I would talk to the patient about the rationale, the risks, and the benefits for the surgery. I would make sure that he is fully resuscitated and I would mark a stoma in the preoperative area as well.
Acutely worsening patients are at risk for developing fulminant colitis or toxic megacolon. Fulminant colitis represents a severe form of acute colitis that may involve more than 10 bloody stools per day, bleeding, fever, tachycardia, and abdominal pain and distension. Imaging may reveal colonic dilation and a thick edematous colon with a thumb-printing sign. Toxic megacolon, an extreme form of colitis, is usually associated with a thin colon wall and total or segmental colonic dilation with a diameter greater than 5.5 centimeters without a mechanical obstruction, but with systemic toxicity. Both on the exam and in real practice, patients with severe medically refractory ulcerative colitis, fulminant colitis, or toxic megacolon should undergo total abdominal colectomy urgently with endoleostomy. A proctectomy should be avoided in these situations. While you may be tempted to ask for a cross-sectional imaging or consult GI, this patient has already been given maximal medical therapy for ulcerative colitis, and not only have they failed, but they're presenting with sepsis. Further surgical delay in his care could lead to significant morbidity and mortality. All right, he agrees with your plan, and you proceed to the OR for open total abdominal colectomy. You note a focal perforation in the descending colon with feculent peritonitis. How are you going to manage the rectal stump?
Yeah, so my options are to leave the rectal stump in the pelvis with adjacent drainage. I could bring it up through the fascia as a buried mucous fistula, or I could mature it as a mucous fistula. And I would base my decision on how healthy the tissue is and whether it can hold a staple line, and how easily I would be able to mobilize the stump and bring it up to the abdominal wall. I would ideally favor creating a buried mucous fistula, given my concern for a rectal stump blowout based on the patient's history. I would also thoroughly examine the small bowel to confirm there is no evidence of creeping fat to suggest Crohn's disease, and make a preliminary assessment of whether he's a candidate for a J-pouch based on small bowel reach.
Given the concerns for developing a rectal stump dehiscence, a variety of maneuvers can be utilized, such as implanting the rectal stump in the subcutaneous tissues, creating a mucous fistula instead of a rectal stump, or decompressing the rectal stump transanally via a rectal tube. There's no single best answer in this scenario, but it's important to know each of these options and be prepared to defend your decision. If the clinical condition permits, it is always good practice to plan your next surgery by evaluating the small bowel. All right, so you perform a total abdominal colectomy with an endoleostomy and buried mucous fistula of the rectal stump. There's no evidence of small bowel disease, and there appears to be adequate reach for a pouch. He recovers well postoperatively. You're seeing him back in the clinic in 1 month, and he asks you if the ileostomy can be reversed.
Yeah, I'd want to review the final pathology closely to confirm that this is consistent with ulcerative colitis. I would then discuss with the patient the options of completion proctectomy with either permanent end ileostomy or ileopouch anal anastomosis to restore GI continuity. In either case, I would review with him the risks and benefits of each approach, including expected quality of life with a J-pouch with approximately 6 to 10 bowel movements per day and possibility of nighttime fecal incontinence. I would assess also his nutritional status and ensure that he is optimized preoperatively.
Total proctocolectomy with ileopouch anal anastomosis, end ileostomy, or continent ileostomy are all acceptable options for patients with ulcerative colitis undergoing elective surgery. Patients with ulcerative colitis undergoing proctectomy should be counseled regarding possible effects on fertility, pregnancy, sexual function, and urinary function. There is, of course, much more detail you can go into about counseling of patients, but you need to be able to highlight the main points in a succinct fashion to show the examiners you are aware of functional consequences with a pouch. Pouch surgery often utilizes a J-type configuration because of its ease of construction and relatively predictable emptying. J-pouches are associated with fewer evacuation difficulties compared with S-type pouches, although an S-type pouch construction may be particularly useful when additional length is needed for a tension-free pouch anal anastomosis. Ileopouch anal anastomosis may not be suitable for all patients and may not be appropriate for patients with advanced age, significant medical comorbidities, underlying bowel dysfunction, or morbid obesity. Total proctocolectomy with an end ileostomy is an alternative to ileopouch anal anastomosis and is a safe, effective, and curative operation with quality of life outcomes equivalent to pouch surgery. This non-restorative approach may be the preferred operative strategy in patients with fecal incontinence, inadequate access to a bathroom on a daily basis, anorectal disease, barriers to surveillance of the pouch, or limited physiologic reserve secondary to comorbid conditions who might be at risk for a pouch failure or poor pouch function. A continent ileostomy, a cock pouch, is a potential option for highly selective patients in whom pouch anal anastomosis is contraindicated or has already failed, or in those who otherwise prefer a permanent ileostomy over a restorative procedure. Although continence is achieved in most patients, these reservoirs have high rates of dysfunction and of needing operative revision or excision. Total abdominal colectomy with iliorectal anastomosis may be considered in selected patients who have ulcerative colitis with relative rectal sparing. All right, he decides he does want to proceed with a J-pouch, so briefly describe your technique.
I would start by opening the midline incision and taking down the rectal stump from the abdominal wall. I would proceed with completion proctectomy, and prior to dividing the rectum distally, I would take down the ileostomy and make sure I assess the reach of the planned J-pouch. I would then transect the rectum and create a 15-centimeter ileal pouch by making an enterotomy at the anti-mesenteric border of the apex of the pouch using two loads of a GIA 75mm blue load stapler. I would then sew in the anvil of an EEA 29mm stapler and perform an end-to-end stapled pouch to anal anastomosis, ensuring there's no tension on the anastomosis itself. I would then make a diverting loop ileostomy 20 centimeters proximal to the body of the pouch.
In terms of technique, a stapled anastomosis is typically preferred over a mucosectomy with hand-sewn anastomosis because the data do suggest improved bowel function and symptom-specific quality of life metrics with this approach. You do need to be aware of how to describe a mucosectomy with hand-sewn approach. When asked to describe an operation on the oral boards, this should be done in 1 minute or less. And it's something that you should practice out loud. You want to make sure to describe the key steps and then note some of the key structures you need to avoid injuring and how to avoid some of the major pitfalls. For example, for left-sided anastomosis, describe performing a well-vascularized, tension-free anastomosis. Typically, you want to describe performing a leak test. In a situation with a low colorectal or coloanal anastomosis that you're planning to defer anyway, some may argue that a leak test is superfluous as it won't change your management. Never hurts to describe performing a leak test. Otherwise, there are many different ways to perform a J-pouch, and feel free to describe the one that you are the most comfortable with. All right, let's say that you're having difficulty with reach of the pouch. What are some of your pouch lengthening maneuvers?
Yeah, I would make sure that the small bowel mesentery is completely mobilized off of the retroperitoneum all the way up to the ligament of Treitz. I could also divide the ileocolic vessels at its takeoff of the superior mesenteric artery. And I could also make a transverse mesenteric relaxing incisions on both sides of the mesentery through the peritoneum.
It is nearly a guarantee that you will have some form of question asking about anastomotic reach maneuvers, whether that's for a colorectal anastomosis, coloanal anastomosis, or pouch anal anastomosis. Know all of your maneuvers and, generally speaking, the order in which you will try first. Tall patients, those with a high BMI, and patients with extensive previous abdominal or pelvic operations are particularly at risk for encountering a problem with reach. Weight loss in anticipation of surgery may be helpful, Maneuvers in the operating room that are routinely employed to facilitate reach include high ligation of the ileocolic vessels, complete release of the small bowel mesentery from the retroperitoneum, mobilization of the duodenum, an excision of the redundant mesenteric tissue lateral to the superior mesenteric vessels, or gypsail. Releasing incisions across the mesentery anteriorly prior to making the pouch perpendicular to the small bowel mesenteric vessels supplying the pouch can also provide adequate reach. You can also make releasing incisions across the mesentery posteriorly after making the pouch if you need additional reach. While sacrificing branches of the SMA or even the main trunk of the SMA may be required to improve reach, these maneuvers can compromise the blood flow to the pouch and are rarely required. Difficulty with reach of the pouch can be anticipated before rectal transection by using a long Babcock forceps to simulate the reach of the most dependent part of the bowel to be used in the creation of the pouch and delivering this bowel down into the pelvis. Manual palpation through the anal canal helps determine the anticipated reach of the mobilized bowel. This exercise, best done prior to completing the proctectomy, can alert the surgeon that there may be a reach issue, and the operation can be modified to increase the chance of a successful ileopouch anal anastomosis. In cases where reach remains a problem despite implementing the maneuvers described above, it may be helpful to orient the pouch coming down to the ileopouch anal anastomosis with its mesentery oriented anteriorly, as this can release tension across the tissues. In certain circumstances and where the pathology permits, the rectal stump may intentionally be left slightly longer in order to minimize tension at the ileopouch anal anastomosis. If a J pouch cannot reach appropriately, changing to an S configuration may be advisable as this adds approximately 2 centimeters of extra reach to the pouch anal anastomosis. In rare cases where a pouch is created and insufficient reach cannot be remedied, it is recommended to secure the closed pouch to the pelvis and create a defunction ileostomy. This maneuver may allow the pouch to lengthen over time in anticipation of a repeat attempt at ileopouch anal anastomosis. All right, let's say that on post-op day 7, he develops fever, tachycardia, pelvic pain, and urinary retention. You obtain blood cultures, urine cultures, and CT chest, abdomen, pelvis. And this reveals a rim-enhancing pelvic fluid collection with partial disruption of the pouch anal staple anastomosis. How are you going to manage him?
Yeah, I'm concerned that he has an anastomotic leak and is developing pelvic sepsis despite proximal diversion. And so I start him on empiric broad-spectrum antibiotics, begin fluid resuscitation and place a Foley catheter. I would then consent him for laparoscopic possible open pelvic washout with exam under anesthesia and possible drain placement, depending on findings.
Likewise, you will almost certainly have to deal with a patient on the oral boards who has an anastomotic leak. As with any patient scenario, you will need to start with assessing whether the patient is sick or not. No matter what type of anastomosis it is, if the patient is sick, this will almost always warrant return to the OR with proximal diversion. If they are not sick, then there is the option of percutaneous drainage with or without proximal diversion. This, of course, is also dependent on whether this is a right-sided, left-sided, or low pelvic anastomosis. In this specific scenario, you have a patient who is post-op day 7 from an ileopouch anal anastomosis with diverting loop ileostomy. Just because the patient is diverted does not mean they cannot become ill from the leak. The examiner has given you the appropriate workup, but you may also be faced with a scenario where you are asked to do the workup. Be sure to cast a wide net when working up a postoperative patient with fever and tachycardia. Pelvic pain and urinary retention as additional symptoms should prompt you to consider pelvic sepsis due to anastomotic leak. In patients with an abscess amenable to percutaneous drainage, prompt drainage and broad-spectrum IV antibiotics administration may allow for control of the sepsis and may minimize the long-term consequences to the pouch. Whether abscess drainage should be performed transanally or percutaneously is a matter of debate due to concerns of the development of an extra-sphincteric fistula related to percutaneous drainage. when a break in the anastomotic integrity is demonstrated coexistent with an abscess, transanal drainage through the anastomosis is preferable. However, when the anastomosis is intact, percutaneous CT-guided drainage is preferable. This strategy allows prompt drainage of abscesses while minimizing the risk of an extra sphincteric fistula.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Knife Premium Oral Board Review. Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.